I'm Christopher Lydon with what looks to me like a solution to the riddle of India in the Afghan-Pakistan emergency, in the so-called war on terror in general. Siddharth Varadarajan is the strategic affairs editor of The Hindu in New Delhi. He's among the stellar public intellectuals at Brown University this year of India at Brown, and I think he can explain what India really wants and doesn't, expects and believes about this fighting north of the border. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Siddharth Varadarajan, the Americans I know are resigned, some of them very unhappily, to a long war now in Afghanistan under the Obama regime. Is this the prospect you see from India?
Well, I think India, for the longest time, India was not very comfortable with the entry of big powers into a region that we considered our backyard. During the Cold War, India tried its best to remain non-aligned. But what's happened since 9/11 and the attack, the invasion of Afghanistan by the United States, with the expulsion of the Taliban and an attempt by the international community to rebuild Afghanistan and to strengthen the Karzai government, what's happened is India has seen a lot of virtue in that. And today, given the kind of forces that are arrayed against the Karzai government, the Taliban, which has a record of being anti-Indian, anti-India, quite apart from the fact that they provide sanctuary to terrorists who have targeted other parts of the world, keeping the Taliban out and ensuring that Afghanistan continues its transition towards stability is a major Indian preoccupation. And to the extent to which the United States is militarily involved and, in a sense, pursuing the same goal, there is broad support in India for the continuing American presence in Afghanistan, which is not to say that India would like that presence to be open-ended. It's not to say that India does not have problems with the way in which America has used its military force in that country. But I don't think you would have many supporters in India for the suggestion that America should just up and run. I think the U.S. has went there for a reason. And it's essential that that task of defeating the Taliban, defeating Al-Qaeda, and in a sense restraining, putting permanent restraints on those elements within the Pakistani military establishment that have had links with the Taliban, I think putting an end to that is absolutely crucial, not only for India, but for the United States. And I think that's the goal that everybody in India hopes the U.S. will see through to the end.
That was the very broad rationale that was given around the time of Prime Minister Manmohan Singh's visit to the White House last winter. But there are so many holes in it that I'd love you to push. Does India like the air war? What does India say about the drones? What does India really expect out of the Pakistani military and intelligence? Cross-examine that strategy about which you've given a very, very general blessing.
If one takes this, the question that you posed, and peels it aside and answers it layer by layer, I think the American military strategy in Afghanistan over the last decade has suffered from, I think, three fundamental weaknesses which urgently need to be addressed and which are only being dealt with even under General McChrystal and President Obama in a sort of half-hearted manner. The first weakness was the belief that the distant application of force delivered by air over long distance to remote locations in Afghanistan would somehow be an effective way of defeating the Taliban. What we saw then, you know, over an extended period of time, was the was an over reliance on drone attacks, over reliance on long range missile attacks, sending in air power whenever troops on the ground who were kept at quite a minimal level encountered resistance. And one consequence of this long distance war has been an increase or a surge in civilian casualties. I mean, if you look at the figures, I mean, the U.S. doesn't do, as I say, we don't do body counts. The U.N. has an estimate, and you have.
You wonder why not? But.
And you have private academics who have made estimates, and one of the estimates by Professor Mark Herold suggests that the number of civilian casualties since the time President Obama has been in office, the annual kill rate, so to speak, is greater than what existed during the Bush administration, which suggests that the promise of a kinder, gentler counterinsurgency campaign hasn't been delivered. So I think this one flaw, which is fighting from afar, fighting unintelligently, over-reliance on the use of force, I think that's flaw number one. Flaw number two, I think, has been the belief that foreign troops by themselves can bear the brunt of the counterinsurgency campaign and can defeat the Taliban, even though they're operating in a country that historically has never submitted itself to foreign troops. And British and American politicians are acutely aware of the history of Afghanistan, the failure of the British campaigns in the 19th century or the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Despite the lessons of history, the belief that all that you need to do to defeat the Taliban is to surge your troops and have more. I think it's important to have more soldiers on the ground because that lets you stop relying entirely on air power. So troops on the ground are better than air power, but American troops on the ground are an inferior substitute for Afghan troops on the ground. And I think this is really the second flaw that I want to identify, which is an inadequate attention paid in a timely fashion to the development and training of the Afghan National Army. Because in the final analysis, it's the ANA, it's the Afghan security forces, who would have the capacity, the cultural sensitivity and skill to negotiate their way through a complex counterinsurgency campaign of the kind that Afghanistan is witnessing.
This is the Vietnamization idea. It didn't work there. And everybody says it's a long, long way away in Afghanistan.
I think the problem is that the US and Britain never really paid attention to the need to develop Afghan capabilities early enough in the game. I think today you have American and British commanders who lament the relative absence of trained or educated Afghan adults and say, well, even if we wanted to expand the officer cadre of the Afghan army, we don't have enough trained or educated Pashtuns who can do that. You've been there for 10 years. 10 years is long enough to have graduated hundreds of thousands of young boys and girls from the school system into college, university. And, I think it was a question of misplaced priorities and hubris and the fact that the Iraq war took attention away from what was obviously something very, very important, which had to be done and which got neglected. And now the Americans are paying the price for that. So I think that this inadequate reliance on the Afghan army, not funding it enough, not providing enough attention to its training. We see in McChrystal's statements a recognition of the importance of the Afghan army. But I don't see in the kind of funding and the kind of emphasis on training the willingness to, in a sense, walk the talk as far as the Americans are concerned. I think that's one weakness that really needs to be addressed. Of course, historically, you can point to Vietnam, you can point to a lot of other examples. But the problem with those comparisons is that I don't think anybody seriously questions the legitimacy of the war that's going on in Afghanistan. I think it's important not to compare the Afghan war today with what happened in Iraq or what happened in Vietnam. I think this is a war that's quite different. The forces that are ranged against the Karzai government are forces that, were they to come to power, would be extremely damaging to the interest of the Afghan people and the entire region and the world. And I think that's what, in a sense, marks this conflict out as something quite different from, say, Iraq. The third critique, or the third flaw in the American strategy has been an over-reliance on Pakistan or an underappreciation of the fact that the Pakistani military and the Pakistani intelligence services continue to nurture links with the Taliban on the assumption that the United States is going to leave. I think Obama talked about 2011 as a target date for beginning withdrawal, but he said this would take a few years. But nevertheless, the fact that you've announced a target date for withdrawal means that the Pakistani military, in a sense, has a built-in incentive to keep alive its links with the Taliban. So I think this flaw, the over-reliance on Pakistan, is something that is likely to prove quite fatal to the success of what America is trying to do there. And it's particularly galling when the Americans have come to the belated recognition that what you're dealing with is not just an AF problem. It's not just Afghanistan. It's actually AFPAC. And you're dealing with, you know, the other day, President Karzai referred to Pakistan and Afghanistan as conjoined twins. This is really a problem of conjointedness, I think, with Pakistan, and the influence is going from Pakistan into Afghanistan. And I think the U.S. policymakers recognize that, which is why they named the region AFPAC. But coming up with a viable strategy to deal with the Pakistani role, I think, has proved rather elusive, which is why today the feeling that many of us in India have is that the U.S. once again seems to be preparing itself for outsourcing its security duties to the Pakistani army. There's a sense of deja vu. When the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, the U.S. Funneled a huge amount of money to the Mujahideen through the Pakistani military and gave the Pakistanis a stake in deciding the outcome of the Afghan war. And I think today, once again, we see that happening, and the consequences are not going to be very benign.
Was it your line that the American policy under Bush and still under Obama is essentially soft on the Pakistani military and hard in its application of often counterproductive military force in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I think this is a fundamental contradiction in American policy, because the root of the problem is the illegitimate desire of the Pakistani military to dominate Pakistani society. And from this illegitimate desire springs a lot of evil, because this means, historically, the Pakistani military has used jihadi groups or extremist groups to undercut, first and foremost, political opposition within Pakistan. So you have mass-based parties like the People's Party of Pakistan, with a long socialist tradition, a tradition of mass mobilization.
Benazir Bhutto's party.
Benazir Bhutto's party, exactly. And one surefire way to undercut the influence of the PPP, and this goes back to General Zia-ul-Huq's time, was to float all kinds of Islamic forces who would then muddy the water, who would create a lot of confusion, and who would appeal to very, very divisive sentiments in order to create a new kind of politics. And over 20 years, after heavy investment by the military, you have a situation today where you have a large number of extremist organizations which have a dense network within Pakistan, which have money, which have personnel, they have well-trained cadres who have been used to destabilize the country domestically, in other words, to undercut domestic political rivals, and also used as a force multiplier against India and as a force multiplier against Afghanistan. So the Pakistani military, which in a sense wants to dominate life in Pakistan, has created a monster whom it is finding very hard to control today. The U.S. strategy really needs to be to force the Pakistani military to change course rather than attacking the symptom of this problem, which is the presence in Afghanistan of the Taliban and then firing drones and missiles from a long distance, killing civilians. So, you have to really deal with the root cause of the problem, which is the nature of the Pakistani military. There's a reluctance to do that. Just like the Pakistani military doesn't want to give up 30 years of investment with the Taliban, I think the Pentagon and the State Department don't want to give up 60 years of investment with the Pakistani military. So you have this, tendency to cling on to your strategic assets in the hope that they will somehow do your bidding. But life doesn't go that way.
Siddharth, you've given us a sweeping critique of a policy that you say you kind of bless. I don't get it. I don't understand, given your critique of the American methods, the American strategy, the American plight with its tar baby Pakistan, why India isn't in Obama's face about a war that you obviously don't believe can be won.
Well, I think India really has limited options here, because there are conversations which happen. The Indians are very upset, I think, with the direction that some of President Obama's policies are going in, particularly his unwillingness to address the root cause of the problem, which is the nature of the Pakistani military. And so there are, suggestions that are made. But India's constraint is that it's a war that America is fighting, and there's only so much of influence that you can have.
Of course, you're not expected to like Pakistan or see the best of any prospect there.
Any argument that the Indians make can easily be discounted by somebody saying, you people have traditional enmity, so why should we listen to you?
And yet, I think more and more it trickles down to us that the Pakistani military, which owns the country, is playing a double game in Afghanistan for its own interests, and it can't work.
In all fairness, there is a growing recognition in the United States about this, as you yourself say. I think to that extent, Indians feel gratified that the lonely fight that they were waging against terrorism emanating from groups within Pakistan has now been joined by the United States and Britain and other countries. I think there's a recognition that the Pakistani military's connections to the Taliban or the Lashkar-e-Tayyaba, this is really a problem that has to go away. You know, in order for you to deal with that problem, I think there has to be a willingness to put pressure on the Pakistani military to adjust its domestic policies, which is not happening. I think President Obama needs to take Afghanistan's neighbors increasingly into confidence, Russia, Iran, China, India. That's not happening. I mean, he promised as part of AFPAC, the AFPAC strategy, greater regional cohesion. But you have no movement at all on the U.S.-Iran front. If anything, you've had a backward movement. I'm not so sure about the degree to which Russia and America see eye to eye on some of the wider issues connected with the AFPAC strategy. And as I said, with India, there is a problem. I mean, India today is quite willing to, for example, train the Afghan army. I think large numbers of Afghan soldiers can be brought to India for training, 3 to 6 month courses, and sent back to Afghanistan. But this is something that the U.S. doesn't want to do, even though it's a cheaper option, because it's afraid of how Pakistan will react. So in essence, the U.S. has given Pakistan a veto over the extent to which India can be involved, even though it knows that Indian involvement would largely be benign. I don't think India is looking to score points over Pakistan, but the U.S., in a sense, does not want to alienate Pakistan by giving India any role on the training front.
Two questions. One has to do with the regional solution, so-called. The other has to do with India's own experience confronting insurgency and the Pakistan power in Kashmir. But first, the regional. On its face, looking at the map, it would seem much sounder in the long term to be engaging the neighbors, as you say, Russia, China, Iran, in the Afghanistan-Pakistan mess. How would it work if the neighbors could be engaged? And why doesn't American policy look that way?
I think right now the American policy is fixated on making sure the surge works. I think the military feels it has a winning strategy. And it feels that...
General McChrystal doesn't quite say that.
Right.
He says this way we won't lose tomorrow, but he doesn't say we'll win, much less when.
No, I think, I mean, they have a plan with whether they can deliver on that, whether it's going to work, who's to say? I mean, I think it's a tough call. But they're working to a certain strategy. Part of that strategy involves trying to extract the maximum cooperation from Pakistan. And the Pakistanis have also, in a sense, demonstrated to the Americans their ability to play the role of a spoiler. You know, there were incidents in the last 6 months when American convoys were attacked on the road from Peshawar to Kabul. Huge convoys just, you know, destroyed by the Taliban. And there was a feeling that information was leaking from the Pakistanis. You know, so the sense that that you need the Pakistanis on your side, you have to humor them, is something that the American military seems to have bought into. And I think as long as that is the approach, as long as you're looking to increase your dependence on Pakistan, you are not going to explore the regional option to that extent, because obviously any Indian involvement would be a negative for Pakistan. Pakistanis are not too hot about the Russians getting involved. Pakistan and Iran have all kinds of problems between themselves.
And China?
The Chinese is one country that Pakistan wouldn't mind being involved. But the Chinese are very pragmatic. I mean, the Chinese are the largest foreign investor in Afghanistan right now. They have a huge contract in copper mines in Afghanistan, but they, you know, unwilling to get involved in you know, on the security front. If the U.S. were to come up with a serious proposal, for example, that Russia, India, China, Iran could join hands and contribute in some way to the training of the Afghan police and the Afghan army, I think that could be something that would be quite workable. But I don't see the U.S. making that kind of offer, because it doesn't want China or Russia or Iran or India to get involved to that extent. So there is still a degree of competitiveness, great power rivalry that's operating here, which is complicating the entire equation and which is, in a sense, making it much more difficult for Obama to find the kind of logical solution that the situation demands. I think he's made a call that, okay, let's let McChrystal, let's give him time to implement his strategy. He's giving them the numbers, but he's also announced a withdrawal date. At the same time, you find this talk, especially after the London conference, of having reconciliation with the elements of the insurgents. There is
the good Taliban. What's your line on that?
You know, I think fortunately, this good and bad Taliban is a division that the US and Britain themselves have stopped speaking about. But the, you know, there was a recent speech by David Miliband, the British Foreign Secretary, where he distinguished between Taliban and Al-Qaeda insurgents and those who may subscribe to conservative Islamic beliefs and have a conservative world vision or a conservative idea of a social order, and we should try to make peace with them. Which is, you know, these are all noble goals, although I think at some stage it's going to come up against issues like women's rights and, you know, all the other things that were quite central to this entire campaign. But from the Indian point of view, I think the most important issue to emphasize is that whoever gets involved in the Afghan political process must accept the Afghan constitution or the goal of a multi-ethnic, plural Afghan society, must agree that the territory of Afghanistan will never be used to stage attacks against other countries or to provide a sanctuary to terrorists who have attacked other countries. I think respecting the neutrality of Afghanistan has to be a non-negotiable. I think if there are elements who renounce the use of violence but who are ambivalent about what the policy of a future Afghanistan would be towards its neighbors, I think it's very hard to have reconciliation with them. But if you can find a way of ensuring the neutrality of Afghanistan, and if these people are committed to that, and you have strong enough political forces existing which can hold negative elements in check, I think, you know, this could well be viable. But I think the key issue really is this offer of integration being made today from a position of strength or a position of weakness? Mm. My sense is that it's being made today from a position of weakness, which is what has made the Taliban and the Taliban's backers in Pakistan more assertive, because they feel that the West is talking about good Taliban, bad Taliban, because they really have no strategy and they're desperate. Looking for an excuse to get out. And it's part of the, I suppose, the package of outsourcing the final sort of settlement to Pakistan, which is something that you have increasingly people in Britain and America talking about.
If General McChrystal or Barack Obama asked India, what is your experience in Kashmir with insurgency, with Pakistan? What could it tell us about the problem and at least a way to a solution in Afghanistan? What would India say?
Well, I think the Indian experience is instructive because Kashmir also suffered for many years from terrorists who crossed the border from Pakistan, who had the logistical backing of the Pakistani, you know, intelligence and military establishment, and really followed no norms of conduct. So they would target civilians and so on. The Indian government managed to, I wouldn't say defeat them entirely because they're still around, but certainly hugely weaken them to the point where militarily they don't really matter anymore, primarily by a counterinsurgency strategy that was based on the domination of territory. So in other words, Indian soldiers never gave up any territory. They went into Kashmir. They were stationed there. More importantly, you had from amongst villagers and local communities, you had intelligence assets, people who could keep track of movements, who could inform you, so that the police and the security forces, in a sense, always had the upper hand. In Afghanistan, the Afghan National Army is the only force that can play that role. The mistake that the coalition made for 7 years, 8 years, was to rely on electronic intercepts, which are inaccurate, or to have very, very inexact intelligence reports. And based on those inexact reports, send in very, very heavy power, air power, with devastating consequences. In India, even when there was intelligence about terrorists holed up in a particular building, there would be, you know, an attempt to use a strategy which may lead to casualties on your own side, but which ultimately, you know, was aimed at minimizing the collateral damage. Which is not to say that the Indian security forces haven't killed civilians. I think large numbers of civilians have died, but it doesn't compare at all to the manner in which this has happened in Afghanistan.
I take it goes without saying that India never used drones or air power to speak of at all in Kashmir.
Right, absolutely. I mean, the Indian counterinsurgency doctrine avoids. There is no role for air support in such a situation, simply because you cannot control how the missiles and bombs that you chuck from the air are going to impact, right? So there was an awareness of the fact that if you cause civilian casualties through the imprecise use of force, you are only creating a problem for yourself. I mean, McChrystal understood this, right? I mean, in his report, he says, if you take a group of 20 insurgents and you kill two of them, you may believe that you have 18, but even those two people that you've killed have brothers and relatives and uncles who will then join the Taliban. So 20 minus 2 is not 18, it becomes 30. So I think McChrystal understands the dynamic of this, and I think there is some effort to stop the killing of civilians, which is really unacceptable. The kind of, you know, I mean, I'm not blaming Obama for it. Part of the problem is that the American military presence has also ramped up, right, during this time. You know, the American military realizes as the war in Iraq draws down that this is a war that has to be won. And so, you know, so there are a number of reasons why that has happened. It's just, it's disconcerting, though, because it's a foolish strategy. Because if you're causing a large number of civilian deaths, you are creating the grounds for the Taliban to recruit more and more people. And I think this is a problem that the U.S. military leadership at least appears to understand. But whether they can translate that understanding into an intelligent, viable, successful counterinsurgency doctrine really remains to be seen.
Siddharth Varadarajan, this is hugely interesting and not very encouraging, I must say. I'm thinking as you speak, President Obama, in his meetings with Prime Minister Singh, said, let this be the model relationship of great powers and great nations in the 21st century. And I'm wondering, how much better does it have to get to the point where friends can say to friends, India to the United States, you've got a terrible strategy in our part of the world. Stop it. Change it. Do something different.
I mean, this conversation happens. I mean, it happens perhaps not at the level of Obama and Manmohan Singh, but AFPAC envoys meet regularly. There are bilateral meetings where India at the official level meets U.S. officials. Holbrooke has come to Delhi quite often. And I think the earlier part of Holbrooke's tenure was spent in India explaining to him why it was not wise for him to seek to link Kashmir and the India-Pakistan conflict with what's happening on the Afghan side. But I think now the emphasis really is on Afghanizing the war, making it more intelligent, dealing with problems of governance, all the issues that got neglected because of the Bush administration's earlier sort of decision to go to war against Iraq. It's had a very negative dynamic on the Afghan side. And I think, you know, the Indians are part of that conversation of telling the Americans, look, some of these things have to change. But there is a reluctance to be more assertive in saying, because, you know, at the end of the day, the Americans are the ones who have forces on the ground. And they
Which
are the ones...
Which is the problem, after
well,
all.
Well, in a sense, I mean, it is the problem, but I don't think the problem would go away, the Afghan problem would be solved if these troops were to get up and leave tomorrow. So this is the complexity. Like, now that you're in there, the whole world appreciates that, you know, you needn't have been there, and, you know, Americans are dying and it's a terrible thing. But the way in which the job has to be done is something which you need to understand. And I think using force which kills innocent civilians is not very wise. Having a strategy which does not put pressure on the Pakistani military to reform itself is not very wise. You know, having a policy that does not seek to draw in Afghanistan's neighbors in the search for a solution is not very wise. So I think these are things which the whole world needs to tell the United States. And I think, you know, India by itself, of course, tries. But I think this is really a process of discussion that has to, you know, is ongoing.
You've told us, and from your lips to Guy's ears, thank you. This is enormously clarifying, for me anyway, and I hope for our listeners. Siddharth Varadarajan, Strategic Affairs Editor of The Hindu in Delhi, thank you. Let's do this again in a year.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.